Hello, West Wisconsin. Let's see what we're up to. Welcome to Spectrum West for a Thursday, the 6th day of March. Things are looking up weather-wise. You also might be listening on a Friday evening, so hi to you too. Today, as the prospect of spring seems nearer, probably putting a hex on it by saying that, we share conversations with Bruce Taylor. He's poet laureate for the city of Eau Claire and instigator of several events throughout the year that feature writers and writing and some reading. We'll preview Saturday evening's Chippewa Valley Symphony Orchestra concert and chat briefly with the sponsor, the Christo Young Artist Competition. Jim Oliver welcomes another Jim Zimmerman, writer, producer, and director of That Love and Feelin', the story of the Righteous Brothers, opening soon in Hudson. Busy violist Aurelien Petiot is here with an exhaustive look at what he's up to and up for, it turns out. We have what's on stage in Western Wisconsin, and we begin today with this. Tim Harmston is from Menominee, but his sense of humor and ability to share it on stage has taken him from coast to coast as a stand-up comedian. He's married to fellow comedian Mary Mack. I don't know about you, but I imagine them trying to discuss something serious. I'll bet it most times ends with a light moment, even squabbles if there are any, you know. Well, Tim's coming home again to grace the stage of the Mabel Tainter Center for the Arts Saturday evening, and I just called him the other day. Comedians are a different breed, obviously. There are ones who just step out on stage and improvise. They have notes. Are you one of those guys who takes notes? Because I know your funnier half takes... See, that's what you do when comedians are married to each other. I know your funnier half takes journals of notes. I've seen her, take the stage and use material so recent that the ink is still wet. Are you a note taker?
Yeah, I'm that guy, except I usually, since we got married, we've been making an effort to get on stage together.
Oh, wow.
So we are constantly on guard for what we call it, our rebuttals. So she'll come up on stage and tear me apart, and then I'll make some notes, and then I'll return the favor. And people seem to be enjoying what we do together. There's no rhyme or reason to what we do. We bring our jokes on stage, and then we just sort of play off each other. And it's kind of given us a new energy on stage, you know, because we've been traveling around individually doing our acts for so many years that it's just sort of refreshing and fun. And, you know, it's an exciting thing. So.
Is everything fair game in that deal? I mean,
yeah, that's funny you should mention that, because we were on stage in Lutzen, Minnesota on Saturday, and a drunk heckler, who, by the way, he said, well, I'm from Wisconsin, so it's okay, while he was heckling. Yeah, and then Mary said something about maybe you'd be a good father for my child or something. She just riffed a line, and I said, wait a minute, you can't say that. And so that was the first time that we had to have a discussion about what's okay to say on stage. And but generally everything's fair game. But neither of us are very dirty or we don't push the envelope too far as far as edginess. But we like to keep it reasonably family-friendly.
Years ago, there were some wonderful comedic pairs.
Sure.
So, yeah, I mean, there could be a future in that. Somebody's got to take over for them, don't they?
Yeah, well, you know, anytime I can insert Tim Harmston and Mary Mack into a sentence, including Lucy and Desi, George Burns and Gracie Allen, I love, there's no pressure involved at all. I don't know if that's what we're necessarily aiming for. We're just trying to have fun, you know? And so whatever it takes to keep it fresh and fun. And people have been requesting, you know, hey, why don't you guys perform together at this show? And so all we say is, can you pay double of what it normally costs? And if they can, then we go.
Is it kind of good for the marriage, too? It's almost therapeutic, I would think, being on stage together. You might go off on a tangent, and you've then taken care of something that may have been building between the two of you.
yeah, sure, Al. That sounds like an ideal situation.
Psychological.
You know, I don't know if it's therapeutic. I get this line all the time. People say, oh, it must be so much fun, you know, living with a comedian. There must be so much laughter in your house. And I always say, well, it's great, but it's not like I have to put vents on the roof to let out all the extra giggles. It's not like it's just comedy all the time. We were really, you know, we're like regular people off the stage. And so when we go on stage, it's more of an like, we're like two jazz musicians playing. It's, you know, like if there was a husband and wife jazz team that played, it would be kind of fun and interesting and fresh and new. And and then that's how we keep it.
I can imagine you two standing at the sink, you know, doing the dishes, and someone says something, wow, there's a bit there.
Yeah, that happens a lot.
Does it happen?
That actually happens a lot, where we'll be driving or talking, and then one of us will say something funny, and we'll look at each other, and then we have to fight over who said it first or where it originated from, or, you know, so that someone can claim ownership to it. That happens a lot. We did the open mic at Acme in Minneapolis last night, and we sat down to write before the show, and we helped each other tag what's called tagging your jokes, you know, making a better ending for it or whatever. So we do work on it together sometimes.
Cool. I was going to ask you about Menominee, you know, growing up in Menominee, but that's a question everybody would ask. And I was going to say, is Menominee a funny place to grow up?
Yeah. Well, I was lucky and blessed to have a father who was very, very funny, and then uncles that were very funny. And so sitting around the campfire was always just just joke after joke after joke. And so I just learned from a small child that's kind of the language that our family spoke sometimes. So I was just really lucky. And then going into high school, we had, that was the age of the camcorder, you know, when you could finally go buy your own video camera and turn it on and make funny things happen. And so, you know, that kind of spawned a lot of the comedy skits and the YouTube things that I do now. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, I went to film school and would make funny videos in film school. So humor has always been a part of what I do. But Menominee, I think, is especially funny because there's something about a small town. First of all, it's filled with amazing people and great people, and they embrace the arts. So you could afford to be different. UW Stout is there, and there's crazy professors, and there's an energy in the town. And so I think it wasn't a small town where, like in Footloose, where you couldn't dance or you get in trouble. You know, there was like the yeah. Being weird and dynamic was encouraged. And so there were so many funny people that came out of the town, and so I felt safe saying I want to be a comedian, and that was okay. Yeah. But it's also funny because there's an identity that a small town tries to have. Every small town tries to forge its own identity, and Menominee chose a slogan, I don't know, about 20 years ago, I'm guessing. It was traditional yet progressive, and that was the town slogan.
Sure.
And so when I saw that, I drove into town, and they had built this huge technology park, and like one of the first businesses they put in it was a funeral home. And that sort of defined traditional yet progressive.
It does. You're making progress towards something when you go to...
Yeah.
Tim Harmston with us. He's Saturday evening at the Mabel Tainter Center for the Arts. It all begins at 7:30. Talking about Menominee. I don't think there is one yet, but eventually there'll be a sign that says home of Tim Harmston, I think, when people drive in. See if we can...
Yeah, I don't think that's in the near future. But if they do have a sign like that, it'll be the one, you know, the snowplow comes by and blows it over. And it'll be up for like one winter.
And they won't put it back up. Yeah.
No, it'll be too expensive.
I don't want to stir the jealousy pot. But are there comic groupies out there?
We call them comedy nerds. Nowadays, you almost have to be a nerd to keep up with podcasts and Twitter.
Sure.
And all the new technology, Instagram, things that people access their fans with. It's not just turn on the TV. They're podcasts, and as my mom calls them, iPods. So that's we call them comedy nerds. And Speaking of that, Mary and I did a podcast with a really funny comedian named Shane Moss. He lives in L.A., but he's from La Crosse, actually. Very mm-hmm. funny guy. He's mm-hmm. been on Conan many, many times. And I told a story about my mom and how she doesn't like it when I swear. I told a story on the podcast, and my mom actually figured out how to download a podcast or iPod. She goes, well, as I was listening to this, I thought, I'm just going to pick up this phone and call them direct. And I had to tell her that she downloaded it. It had been on iTunes for probably 3 weeks before she downloaded it. But
No kidding. Sounds to me, Tim, like you and when you're on stage with Mary have settled into kind of a nice rhythm. Is that the case? Or do comedians always have their sights set on the mountaintop?
The thing about Mary is that she takes improv lessons, and she's a very accomplished improviser. Mm. And for my birthday, she was going to buy me improv lessons. I don't improvise very well, so when we're on stage, the rhythm can be kind of clunky. But that seems to be where the humor comes from, is that I can't keep up with her. That's one of the things that we're working on is finding what's funny between us telling jokes to each other. You know, and so we're just doing that. And, of course, we'd like to be successful and take this to another level and figure out what the next step is. But we're having fun along the way, and that's the most important part.
Tim Harmston, thanks for being with us on Spectrum West. Keep us giggling. I know you will. Saturday evening, Mabel Tainter Center for the Arts. Going to be fun to go home, isn't it?
Yeah, I always love coming home. So it's in the Mabel Tainter, you know, if you don't know, it's mm-hmm. a tremendous place to perform.
Hey. Give yourself something to laugh about. Saturday night, 7:30, Mabel Tainter. 235-0001 is the phone number for tickets. MabelTainter.com is the website.
Support for WPR comes from a Second Opinion magazine dedicated to local alternative health and wellness. The Earth Day issue is now available, featuring recycling and sustainable living. Details are available at asecondopinionmag.com. Support also comes from the Chippewa Valley Theater Guild presenting The Foreigner, an ensemble comedy set in a southern lodge, March 6th through 16th at the Grand Theater in Eau Claire. Details and tickets are available at cbtg.org.
Spectrum Memo, the St. Croix Valley Symphony Orchestra is hosting concerts Friday at noon and Sunday at 3 p.m. at Abbott Concert Hall in the Kleinpel Fine Arts Building at UW River Falls. Speaking of orchestras, Saturday evening at 7:30, the Chippewa Valley Symphony resumes its season with a program called Russian Music. The event features the Chippewa Valley Youth Symphony and Isabella Wu. She's a young pianist from Madison, this year's winner of the Christo Young Artist Competition. Dr. Steve Christo is an Eau Claire native and the namesake of Christo Orthodontic Specialists, sponsors of the competition for years.
As long as I've been practicing, 25 years, we've had a commitment to culture, kids, and competition to a certain degree. And I think the cultural basis of where Eau Claire sits in relationship to what I do makes it important that we try to keep Eau Claire a cultural hub. Take the Young Artist Competition, for example. That's something that McDonald's sponsored before me when I came to town. And they gave it up. The contest was going to go away. And I just didn't think that seemed very right. So we jumped in. That was probably 12 years ago, and we've been sponsoring it ever since. And there's been a number of local winners, kids that I've treated and taken care of. But like this year's winner is from Madison. Mm-hmm. As they start to draw from far away, you know, Madison, Minneapolis, Superior, they draw really a nice connection, which shows how far Eau Claire maybe reaches in the cultural world. And it's kind of the cultural hub of West Central Wisconsin.
It's really done a lot, especially for the symphony.
The symphony is fabulous. And then that youth symphony, and the youth symphony is just amazing.
Yeah. Personally, your appreciation for the arts, were you a musician? Were you an artist before you started looking into people's mouths?
I have absolutely zero musical ability. I love music. I love to listen to it. It's actually my two middle kids right now. We have an 8-month-old baby, and he's not playing the piano yet, but my 10 and 12-year-old are both taking piano. My 10-year-old takes guitar. And I've always thought that the two things I wish I would have done was learned the piano, and I really wish I'd have done that when I was younger, and I kind of regret the days that I didn't do that. So I love music, and I think it's a huge part of any community is to have that connection with kids that have those abilities and to try to foster their goals. I mean, so much of what we do is about sports and, you know, all that, but, the other kids that don't have that sport interest need the cultural.
Yeah, I mean, there are more popular and flashier bandwagons to jump on, but you've chosen to ride this one as long as you have and hopefully will continue. So congratulations on that. That's pretty cool.
Thanks. I'm sure we'll continue to ride it. I think it's a great endeavor for hopefully our community.
How involved are you in the process?
I get to present the award to the winner each year, which is great fun for me.
Sure.
They've always asked me to be involved in the judging of competition, and every year for the last 5 years I've had a conflict. So, you know, it's my goal for my wife and I to become even more involved with the competition and all the things that we try to get involved with on a personal level, too. But, you know, sometimes scheduling and previous commitments get in the way of some of that.
You obviously believe in a legacy, leaving something for future generations.
Absolutely. I love to, you know, I think it's important that we leave a certain print. You know, I've gotten such a great life from this community and what I do, and I think it ties back nicely that I can try to be a productive and a good source of giving back to the community, and hopefully that leads other people to want to do exactly the same, which is what builds a great community.
Early on in your medical career, did you know that you were going to choose wanting to work with young people?
You know, I didn't know that that would be my forte, but it has been a natural. As I've aged, it's a great way for me to stay young. And every year, our patient population actually gets older, but the kids are just a blast to work with. You know, I really get a charge out of trying to communicate with them and seeing how they change era to era, you know, and how the kids respond to what we do for them and how it benefits them and their confidence and their self-esteem, and it can be a real kick.
So on behalf of the people who enjoy and place a great value on the entertainment and enrichment we receive from the arts, thank you for providing the kind of support that assures its preservation, as I said, for generations to come.
Happy to do it.
Steve Christo, another of the fine patrons of the arts that we find so prevalent in West Wisconsin. Thanks to all of you for not only keeping it alive, but for allowing it to grow. Again, the symphony concert is Saturday, 7:30 p.m., State Theater, Russian Music, it's called, featuring the Youth Symphony and this year's winner of the Christo Young Artist Competition. Her name is Isabella Wu. She's from Madison, who I hear is just marvelous. More Spectrum Memoranda. The UW River Falls Rad Jazz Series presents the UWRF Jazz Ensemble in concert Saturday, 7:30 p.m. in Abbott Concert Hall. The Symphony Band and Wind Symphony perform Sunday evening at 7:30 in Gantner Concert Hall at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire. Tickets at the Service Center and at the door, I'm guessing. Don't forget, Arts West 35 is open at the L.A. Phillips Memorial Public Library in Eau Claire. 64 pieces from 49 artists are on display through April 4th. A little bit of You've Lost That Lovin' Feelin', one of my favorite Righteous Brothers tunes. On that topic, Jim Oliver has a taste for theater, and this week it has even more flavor. He has news about dinner theater in Hudson. Here is Mr. Oliver.
Righteous, the story of the Righteous Brothers, had a run 2 years ago at the St. Croix Off-Broadway Dinner Theater in Hudson. It was written by James A. Zimmerman, who is owner of the Dinner Theater and also a professor of theater at the University of Wisconsin-River Falls. That Lovin' Feelin', the story of the Righteous Brothers, which is a revised version of the previous show, also written by James A. Zimmerman, will open Friday, March 14th at the St. Croix Off-Broadway Dinner Theater. Joining us by telephone to talk about the revised show is the aforementioned James A. Zimmerman. Jim Zimmerman, welcome back to Spectrum West.
Well, I'm glad to be here. That's quite an introduction.
Well, I do my best. For the benefit of those youngsters whose knowledge of the music of the Righteous Brothers is limited to what they may hear on oldies radio, give us a little background on the duo.
Well, that's opening Pandora's box as far as I'm concerned. But the Righteous Brothers were not brothers. It's Bobby Hatfield and Bill Medley became the Righteous Brothers around 1963 and had hits in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s. And a lot of folks, you know, recognize their music, but they don't really realize that it's actually the Righteous Brothers that created it. But You've Lost That Lovin' Feelin', of course, is their number one hit, most popular song, most played song on the radio, still is to this day. You know, and so they've got, you know, a whole litany of songs that you may have heard on the radio, and you go, oh, that's theirs. And that's basically the nature of the music from the right, from that's in that Love and Feeling.
Why don't you tell us that story about how they became the Righteous Brothers?
Bill Medley was very much into sort of doo-wop and that sort of thing. Early rock music was just a fad at that point. But he got into the R&B, the rhythm and blues material, because they were all listening to, early R&B music, most of it by black artists. In fact, all of it by black artists. So there are very few white guys that actually sang R&B type music and sang it well. But it turned out that both Bill and Bobby loved R&B, and that's what drew them together as a duo or as a combo with the Righteous Brothers group. It was the one common love that they had, even though as personalities they clashed from the day that they basically started together until Bobby Hatfield's death in 2003.
And that was the year that they were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, as I recall.
Yeah, it was about 6 months before Bobby died. Bobby died in November. They were scheduled to do, and they were at Kalamazoo, Michigan, right on the heels of their induction in the Hall of Fame. They were more popular than ever. They were booked around the country and had this great tour going, and Bobby Hatfield passed away.
Now, they had broken up for a time before they got back together again.
Well, they had broken up twice.
Oh.
They broke up twice, got back together twice, so they really had three different parts of their career. The early stages, a breakup, a second phase, and then Karen, Bill Medley's ex-wife at the time, passed away, and so Bill had to break out of the Righteous Brothers in order to take care of Darren, his son. So then they broke up a second time, although they weren't getting along even at that point where Karen had died, so it was not difficult for Bill to step back at that point. But then they eventually got back together again a third time, and they were together right to the end.
Hmm. Well, you told me earlier that the original production was quite successful for the theater in Hudson. So why did you decide to do a revision?
Actually, the reason for the revision is there's one primary reason. I thought I could do it better, more completely. And that first version that we did 2 years ago was really meant as a beta test of the script. And it was quite successful. We had sellout crowds. But we set it up originally as a means of testing the show to see if it ran and worked well as a theatrical production, but always with the idea in the back of our minds that we were going to rewrite it and make it better. I went back after the original production to Bill Medley and David Cohen, his manager, and some folks out of New York, and Brent Hazeltine from the Milwaukee Repertory Theater. And all these folks sort of gave me constructive comments on how we could make the show better. And so I took those comments back, and there was a lot of commonality in their responses between them. So I took their comments back and reconstituted the script, took out about two or three numbers, added about three or four other numbers into the show. Basically, the biggest change is that we get a chance now to see more about who these people are. And less part of the problem with the original show, or the concern with the original show, there's a lot of narration and a lot of sort of sit and talk about it. Well, in this version, you'll see a lot more of it taking place.
He is Jim Zimmerman, who is a playwright and director of That Love and Feelin', the story of the Righteous Brothers. You told me that you got back with Bill Medley again on working on this revision. Is he still performing?
You bet he is. He's out about 100 nights, 100 shows a year. He is about 74 now, but he sings as good as he ever did and loves performing. So he keeps a modest, though regular, schedule of performances going. He was over and performed at Wembley Stadium, I believe, a few months ago. And when I last talked with him, he had a tour sort of scheduled for Australia, and I think that's a bit on hold at the moment, but he's out touring and singing as good as he ever did. He actually performed at the Hinckley Casino last spring based on the observations that he made from our first production. He loved the guy that played Bobby Hatfield in our show. When I was with him, he actually called Joe Keith is the guy's name, and said, you know, we got to sing sometime together. And it made Joe's day, basically.
Oh, man.
But long and short of it is, when he came to Hinckley last spring, he remembered that and got a hold of Joe and through me and actually pulled him into the show at the Hinckley Casino, and the two of them sang together.
Let's talk about the music. That's what the show is about, really. Talk a little bit about what you changed, what you added, what you subtracted.
What we've added is based on the R&B, black R&B influence, and we've added a lot of storyline about the racial issues, reverse racial prejudice, and the fact that Bill and Bobby really didn't care whether it was black, white, or whatever. It was just music to them. Some of the numbers we've added, What I Say, the Ray Charles classic, because Bill was really influenced by Ray Charles. So that factors into there. We have added Georgia on My Mind, which Bill covered, did a recording of, very influential to their career also early on. And he actually performed it at the California Club, which is a predominantly black club in California in the 60s. And when they appeared on stage, all the folks in the audience obviously were black, and they thought that the Righteous Brothers were black artists. And when they hit the stage, you could hear crickets going, and they were not happy folks. But by the time he'd finished Georgia on My Mind, he had what was 300, you know, folks in the audience were loving the Righteous Brothers. So Georgia on My Mind is added. What I Say is added. I've added a sort of a little tribute section to Elvis Presley, because Elvis was big friends with the Righteous Brothers, particularly with Bill Medley. Bill wrote this song in tribute to Elvis called Old Friend.
The cast, were you able to pull the cast back together again, or is this some new people?
Well, it's some new, it's some old. We have the same folks that are playing the young. I say the young because this is a retrospect. We see Bill Medley at a senior age, because at the time of this interview, Bobby has already passed away at the Radisson, although Bill doesn't know it. So the interview sets the premise for it, but then we take retrospect and we'll go back into the early days and see what happens as the Righteous Brothers evolve. And we've got a younger Bill Medley and Bobby Hatfield. And those are the original folks that we had from our production, and they are just tremendous. But we do have some other folks that are new to the ensemble, and we made some changes in other instances, and I think it's a great cast.
Just a question about the future of this show. Has it been published for general use?
It has not. This will be the second test of the script. We didn't want to release it until we'd done it right. There's interest in, you know, going beyond our production, and it's a lot easier to vend it out to specific theaters for sort of a more major exposure on it. If it hasn't been published, then you don't have third hands and third parties involved. So we've waited to publish it until after the disposition of who wants it, where it's going to go next, is sort of resolved.
We've been visiting with Jim Zimmerman, who is playwright and director of That Love and Feelin', the story of the Righteous Brothers. The show opens Friday, March 14th, and plays Fridays and Saturdays and some selected Sundays through August 9th at the St. Croix Off-Broadway Dinner Theater in Hudson. Thanks so much for coming back to talk to us.
It's a pleasure, Jim.
A couple of gems there. Can't have too many, can we? This is Spectrum West. Thanks for being with us here on Wisconsin Public Radio. The abstract art of Joshua West Smith is on exhibit at UW Stout in the Applied Arts Building. A 20-faculty-member art exhibit is in the North Gallery of Furlong Gallery. The North Gallery features Painting the Personal, Landscape is as Allegory, the work of Associate Professor Tamara Brantmeyer, both through March 16th. The Soup Lunch Series continues at Hunt Hill Audubon Sanctuary in Sorona. The new program is Tuesday, March 11th from noon to 1 p.m. Registration is requested but not required to attend. You can call 715-635-6543. That's 635-6543. Or you can email them at info@hunthill.org. The Northern Lakes Center for the Arts in Amory presents an opening of the exhibit, The Art of the LP, those old record jackets we love so much. That opening is Friday, 7:30 to 9 p.m. in Amory. Well, I get exhausted simply listing all the things in which Aurelian Petio is involved, as is the case with many artisans. He's an educator at UW Eau Claire. He plays the viola by choice in several musical aggregations to which he has to drive some distance to perform. He was recently named conductor of the Red Cedar Symphony Orchestra in Rice Lake. He gives recitals, and Aurelian Petio loves pasting things on YouTube. Interesting, eye-catching things. And then you have some very unorthodox appearances on stage, where you have a viola that's smashed with a baseball bat.
Mm-hmm. That was a piece called Fantasme, which means just fantasy, for viola and baseball bat, and I had somebody show up in a gorilla suit and smash it. Yeah, it was just a viola that couldn't be used anymore. It was beyond repair, and I played exactly what was on the page, and the gorilla with the baseball smashed the viola exactly at the right time, right on cue. Yeah.
And then you have another one where you have these people surrounding you all in different costumes, and they're making little noises as you play.
Yeah, it's the ha chorus. So
oh,
I play
it.
Something
okay.
Pretty fast, pretty rambunctious, and I had a lot of the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire faculty join me on stage and shout as I was playing. And that, too, is a real piece by a New Zealander called Robbie Ellis, and it's a wonderful piece, actually. It's pretty well-written, really fun.
So you are by far the proudest violist I know.
Yes.
You recently spoke to the Chippewa Valley Music Teachers Association meeting, the preview of which labeled you, and I've seen this a couple times before, as a passionate chamber musician, but you're also an advocate of music by living composers. Why are you such an advocate of music by living composers?
Well, as I hear every day when I listen to WPR, there's somebody at some point who shows up and says, all music was once new. And I believe that there are a lot of composers who need to have their voices heard, who are wonderful composers, very talented, very eclectic, very diverse. And as a performer, I think it's very, you know, engaging and fun to get to see that other side of creativity in music and talk to them about their works and see what they're trying to do. And, you know, to me, it's very exciting as well to play music that hasn't necessarily been performed. And we have wonderful composers, wonderful American composers who've won, you know, Pulitzer Prizes and Guggenheim Prizes, and they have a very original and vibrant voice. If they write something for viola that I think is worth performing, I want to perform it and encourage it.
Is it tough to find?
No. I think it's really easy, and composers are eager to have their works performed. So especially now, you know, through Facebook and web pages, you can just contact pretty much anybody you want. You can be friends with Philip Glass and John Adams, not the president, the composer, if you want. And it's really easy. And you tell them, hey, you know, I'm working on this piece, or I saw on your website that you have such and such piece for viola, kazoo, and paperclip. Can you send it to me? Can I play it? And you know, it's a lot of it is actually really beautiful music. Some of it is, you know, really arcane. Some of it is really hard to listen to. But a lot of it is just real, beautiful, interesting works.
Do you find yourself encouraging composers to write for viola?
Yeah, I have. On many occasions, I've commissioned some works. But I think a lot of composers actually do love the viola. They just like the dark, richer alternative to its brethren, the violin and the cello, and it's a very unique voice. And a lot of composers sometimes are violists themselves, and they write for viola.
Well, the appearance of which I spoke, the Music Teachers Association, your topic was the art of musical interpretation, or how to justify spending way too much time on YouTube. Now, we've already covered YouTube, I guess.
just partly.
Yes. Well, and there's much more to come, I'm sure, from you in that regard. But let's go to music interpretation. Word that I've read all my life. And suddenly, because I have someone like you coming in, I say to myself, all right, why is interpretation, or how can it be, or should it be, artistic?
You know, a lot of musicians improvise, and a lot of musicians don't have to read music necessarily. They don't necessarily bounce off the written score. They can pick up a guitar, play on the porch like you do, play a couple of tunes, and it's great. And I think there's so much beauty in that. And a lot of the music we do is actually written from a score. And to me, the idea of musical interpretation equates to acting in many ways, where an actor starts from the page, has to be true to the character, has to be true to the author's intentions. But everybody who reads a play or a specific character will embody that character in different ways. So if you spend a lot of time on YouTube like I've done, and you compare, for example, interpretations of the To Be or Not To Be from Laurence Olivier to Mel Brooks, there's a lot of inflections, a lot of pauses, a lot of voices that you can create mm-hmm. as you read that text. And your own understanding of the character reflects that text. And in ideal situation, you heighten the intentions of the writer or the composer instead of hiding them behind yourself. So the idea is you use your knowledge and your emotions and your understanding of the text to reveal what the composer or the author might be writing about.
Mm-hmm.
And by doing that, you reveal those intentions instead of just putting yourself forward and be, I'm the greatest actor and watch me act or watch me play the viola. So then how do you find that sincerity? How do you find that purity of line, maybe, that phrasing and pacing and your own rhythm with those pieces, then I think is really independent of different players. And, you know, the thing is, we talk about interpretation like we're interpreters, like we're translating a text. And I really believe in that. You have the written text, could be the Dead Sea Scrolls, could be Chaucer's English, could be, you know, a manuscript by Faulkner.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to make something out of it, and you have to decipher it. You have to understand what it is, especially if it's in a foreign language.
Mm-hmm.
You might speak that language, other people might not. So you want to bring them in, translate that language. And so I think we do that in music. That's pretty much what we do. We're translators in many ways.
Another word that's used a lot in music is arrangement.
Mm-hmm.
When does an interpretation become an arrangement? There's got to be a point at which something changes.
Yeah. You know, an arrangement technically is you take, say, a song or you take a piece that is written for a different set of instruments than what you have in mind. So say you have something for a big band and you want something more intimate that maybe Diana Krall might sing with just voice and piano. So you're going to have somebody who takes that texture and brings it down to just voice and piano. So that would be arranging. And that in turn becomes her interpretation of that tune. If you listen to I Put a Spell on You by Screaming Jay Hawkins, and you listen to the version with Nina Simone, it's a totally different version where she's very intimate, she's very passionate, she's very emotional. It's right there, right in your face, in your heart. And Screaming Jay Hawkins is just, you know, he's going to force you to love him, and he's really going to put a spell on you. I mean, you're really going to die with some kind of voodoo trick and some needle through your heart. And the arrangements are totally different. And therefore, their interpretations are different. Now, what's different for my side of the music, the classical world, the composer's word is paramount. And so we try to trust that word, that music, and bring it to life.
It would seem to me that you might want to ask permission from a composer to arrange something, but maybe not interpret.
Yes, you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
But even interpretation, usually, you know, with performing and recording rights, you do have to, you know, contact them, contact the publishers, just so they know that their works are performed. One of the things we do as performers is we look at all those symbols on the page, all those black dots, we bring them to life. The score is basically like a map that tells you, you know, it's the little Siri on your phone that tells you, well, now you turn right.
Aurelien Petiot, Viola by Choice. Music is life. Viola is its inner fire. That's what it says.
I know.
On your YouTube stuff.
That's good. You make
that
intense.
Up?
I did, yeah.
That's cool. Congratulations on your new post as conductor of the Red Cedar Symphony.
Thank you.
Not enough on your plate?
Never. I'm perfectly happy to be busy and to work.
Resume talks about going to Chicago and going to La Crosse.
It's okay. It's all manageable.
You have a recital coming up. Tell us about it.
Well, actually, I have quite a few things coming up. Next Thursday at 7:30, so it's March 13, I have a concert of viola works by women composers. I'll be playing two works by Libby Larson, who lives in St. Paul, and she's one of the most renowned, commissioned, celebrated living composer. I'll be playing a piece by her called Bid Call, which is supposed to mimic the patterns of auctioneers. So that's for saxophone and viola. I'm doing a piece inspired by paintings by Georgia O'Keeffe, also by Libby Larson, a sonata by Pulitzer Prize winner Jennifer Higdon, and a couple of concert etudes by Lillian Fuchs, who was a violist and a composer, and a wonderful 1919 sonata by Rebecca Clark, which is just out of this world because mm-hmm. it's so beautiful. It's very impressionistic, very mercurial, very versatile, and just really engaging. It's just beautiful music all around, and I think people would enjoy that. So this is in Gantner Concert Hall at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire, 7:30. It's free. And at the end of March, I'll have a concert with my trio, the Carrasco Trio, whom you interviewed before.
I have, yes.
So it's going to be March 28th at 7:30 at First Presbyterian Church in Eau Claire. And it's a beautiful Steinway that they have in the hall, in the sanctuary. And I think we're going to be the first one to actually do a concert with that.
So the commitment for Red Cedar Symphony, what does that entail? How often do you get a ride up to Rice Lake?
What it entails for now is just one concert in the spring. Mm-hmm. If they like me, I'll come back in the summer, in the fall. And so I decided to have a concert called Fire and Renewal, with lots of very fiery, interesting pieces for orchestra that will also include two competition winners. We had the concerto competition winners selected maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago. And I'll be playing a wonderful piece by a Mexican composer named Arturo Marquez, and it's Conga del Fuego Nuevo. It's just rambunctious and fun and very Latin. Yeah,
and you say it well.
Well, thanks. And a piece by Beethoven, a piece by Dvorak. So I try to mix, you know, classics and more modern composers.
I'm concerned about you. Do you get enough sleep?
I do.
You do?
Perfectly happy.
You are?
Yeah.
You look okay.
Thanks.
Well, that's good. Thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Me too.
Aurelien Petio. Interesting, talented, enthusiastic participant in life as are most with whom I spend time here on Spectrum West. By the way, the Red Cedar concert is the symphony, April 6th. That's a Sunday, 4 p.m. at the UW Barron County Fine Arts Theater in Rice Lake. And again, Saturday, the 12th of April at 7 p.m. at Chautauqua Lutheran Church. And yes, that is in Chautauqua.
Here's what's on stage in Western Wisconsin theater venues. The Chippewa Valley Theater Guild production of The Foreigner plays through Sunday at the Grand Theater in Eau Claire. Aesop's Fables, a production of the Festival Theater's playwriting troupe, will play through Sunday at the theater in St. Croix Falls. The University of Wisconsin River Falls University Theater will present Vinegar Tom through Saturday at the Sizey Theater in the Kleinpel Fine Arts Building at the university. And the Old Gem Young Performers Ensemble will present Pinkalicious the Musical for student audiences weekdays through March 20th at the Old Gem Theater in New Richmond. And that's some of what's happening in live theater around the region. For Spectrum West, I'm Jim Oliver.
The term of Eau Claire Poet Laureate Bruce Taylor continues, and so do events on which he's worked with others to instigate, one being the popular Writer's Read series, another installment of which is coming up next week. Bruce Taylor stopped in for a visit just a couple days ago. Well, how's the tenure going? How's laureating?
Going good.
Yeah?
Yep. Staying busy, and we've got a couple of reading series going on a regular basis. Mm-hmm.
But when you heard you were going to be poet laureate, didn't something streak through your mind and went, man,
I thought, what does that mean? You know, what am I supposed to do? And I think we've talked before that, you know, the official list of duties is very minimal. And then national laureates, each one is supposed to come up with a project, each new one.
Well, the state, Garland, has had to do a lot of.
Well, he has done a lot. Yeah, Max, has been on the road, and, well, everybody, you know, wants a piece of him. Mm-hmm. And he's obviously got to work, and you know, someone will say, well, come and read for us, and it'll be a two-hour drive or two-and-a-half-hour drive each way, you know?
Well, I noticed you're not wearing a fleece overcoat that says Poet Laureate on
it, so there's nothing. I have the belt.
You have the big buckle?
So we have, you know, we've got the third Thursday at the galleries at the State Theater, at the Art Gallery there. It starts at 5, runs to 6. We have individual poets there. And then the second Tuesdays is Writers Read.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to talk about mostly today, because you have one coming up next week. Pleasant surprise with those events?
Yes. Actually, both of them. But the Writers Read, very much so. I think there's a tendency to count numbers and count heads and think that that's a success. And to some degree, it's true. And certainly the, you know, people that put this on, the great folks at the library who support us and, you know, do this for us, they like to see some numbers rolling in the door. But we have had very good numbers and some followers, some people who are there no matter what's going on, because we've had a wide variety. We've had individual people reading. We've had theme readings where we've brought people in to read on an appropriate theme. We've had open readings. 2 months ago, we had the middle and high school teachers, a bunch of middle and high school teachers in reading their stuff. Huh? And that was very successful. So, there's been a broad brush. I think in our last open reading, our youngest person was maybe 7, and our oldest person was 82.
No kidding. Wow.
So we're hitting to a lot of bases.
Holy. Do writers have to be pushed to read their stuff, or do they like it normally?
No. Most of them like it. You know, they're so used to being ignored that if anybody pays any attention to them at all, they're usually pretty
happy. So most writers are outgoing people. They don't want to just be relegated to sitting in front of a computer and writing.
Certainly not the ones that I'm involved with as far as the reading. I know some people in town that would not read. I could not get them to under any circumstances. I know a few people like that. But most people are willing to help out.
So the writers feel as if it's kind of skill honing in a way to get up and do their stuff?
Perhaps a little bit PR. Every once in a while, they'll even try to sell a book or two.
They always say that, people in radio have a face for radio. Maybe that's what writers want people to realize is that they're not these.
I've noticed over the last few years that all of a sudden you got to be good looking to be a writer. And that sort of puts a lot of us out of business, I'll tell you what.
On March 11th, you're featuring young people. How is a poet developed? Is it important for young people to study and understand structure and verse, or are they encouraged to just simply write and see what comes out?
Well, I think it depends on certainly the student. You know, it's always individual. It's not like if you're training boxers, you would say, well, let's make every boxer like Muhammad Ali. Why wouldn't you? You know, but as anyone knows, you look at the strengths and weaknesses of the particular person, and they had to be handled one way or the other. And I think also it has to do with when they're starting out. People just starting out and they're just getting interested in it, mostly what you want is encouragement.
But isn't it important for them to understand their craft?
Eventually, yes. Okay, I think so, eventually. And unless they're so good, they just have it and don't to understand it.
Some prodigies come up with a new craft, maybe.
Yeah, sure. You know, and when you're judging things like that, particularly with writers, and as a teacher, I was always afraid that I would have been the teacher that said to Walt Whitman, you know, Walt, those long lines, not going to make it. Or Dickinson, the dash, no, get rid of the dash, it's not going to happen. So, you know, you're always a little leery.
Mr. Cummings, you need a capital
you do.
In here.
Throw
once
one
in
once in a while. Yeah. I remember when I was teaching at the university, near the end there, I taught a few senior level formal poetry workshops where the only thing we did was traditional forms. Mm-hmm. And a number of students were really interested. A number sort of were grumbling because that was the only workshop that was offered that semester. You know, even if you don't use the traditional forms and rhythms, the things you learn from experimenting, from messing with them, serve you well as a writer.
There's such a proliferation of stuff out there nowadays. I mean, there used to be a pipe through which things flowed. Now it's Niagara Falls. It's this wide thing and over the top.
It's pretty much accepted that there's probably more people writing poetry now than ever before.
And educators like you, at every kind of level, you were kind of the barometer for people. Now you're accepted by the cyber crowd. You can become a star without ever having been educated at all.
Certainly. And that has happened, I think, in some cases with some people. Mm-hmm. But it's like with so many of the other arts. You know, you can bypass the galleries, you can bypass the publishing houses, you can bypass the editors. You don't need them anymore to say, yes, you're the one that's going to do this and this other person isn't going to do it. I figured out one time there's about 5 things that an editor and a publisher can do for you. And nowadays, a person can do nearly all of those things on their own. The only thing they can't do is to get some advice, to get some tips and hints and have someone look at what you're doing and make some suggestions.
The way I have it written here, stars are born without anyone being pregnant. No labor involved.
I don't know. And even what does a star mean when you're talking about writing poetry?
Exactly. Bruce Taylor's with us, Eau Claire Poet Laureate. The Writer's Read program, the next one is Tuesday the 11th, and these are at the Ellie Phillips Public Library in Eau Claire.
Starting at 7, and I want to give a shout-out to make sure Ken Szymanski, teacher at South and a fine, fine writer, and has been such a help to me in these readings. He's the one that's organizing this student thing because he's got the contacts. I'll set up the chairs, but pretty much everything else.
I can imagine this being a waiting line because young people,
It's the nice thing about any kind of an open reading is that everyone who comes usually brings a couple of friends, or in this case, you know, parents or grandparents or something. I was just talking to Ken recently. He said for weeks now, the kids have been pointing at this, and they've been, you know, doing more writing and really excited about it and showing each other their things. And mostly what I run into is the key to quote-unquote teaching writers, particularly young writers, is you say, gimme, and then you sit back. And it keeps coming.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, that's cool. So what do you have that you're going to read for us?
Well,
so,
you asked me to bring something to help us get through this, the season. I had
Give me some hope.
I was going to bring a summer poem, just a flat-out boy one, you know. But then I thought that's too cruel.
That is too cruel.
You just can't do that. So I did settle for sort of an edge poem, you know, something that's essentially about spring. And you remember spring.
Well, I'm slowly forgetting. But
yeah, what that was supposed to be.
I might recognize it if it shows up.
Yeah, if it shows. So this is from The Longest You've Lived Anywhere, my last book, and it's called Another Year of the Birds. All summer long, there was always a caw, a complaint, or call. And later in the fall, as the breathy clouds, when the winds westerly move endlessly away from you, whole flocks of finch appeared to forage in the weeds that struggle and go to seed where the driveway fractures and drifts, as the continents themselves, we are told, fracture and drift. And in winter at 30 below, your breath escapes you, a white cloud across that big morning star, like one singular and rare chrome wind chimes note. Then a door far off slams, so another does, then a dog barks, and then another. Then the pickups, cars, and vans in their sequence startle the heavily feathered sparrows flocking bare lilacs along four geometric blocks of perfectly shoveled snow. And then the swallows come back to nest in the same inverted flower pot painted whatever color's handy and nailed to a shingle blown off the roof. And then the trees take on their burden again and again. We are left with almost nothing but spring and happiness, the conditional joys.
The next Writer's Read event featuring middle and high school students is Tuesday evening, the 11th, 7 p.m., Eau Claire Room, lower level, Phillips Public Library, downtown Eau Claire, thanks to Bruce Taylor. Thank you. Next week, a young lady, Erica Wheeler, born and raised in our neighborhood, and UW Stout grad who's very much coming into her own as an illustrator of children's and young people's books. And a young man, Nick Butler, who's doing the same thing in literature with a first book, getting very good reviews. And more, always more, on Spectrum West. Bye now.